Welcome back to the program. It seems that the men of Mad Men had it all. Great jobs, lots of money, smart, attractive wives and families, and even more attractive mistresses. As long as the paychecks kept coming in, they had unlimited freedom. But is it possible that these men represented the 1% of their day? That the paradigm and expectations they set up, men with power and money, created a set of responsibilities that made it hard for the other men to live up to? And how did this play out against the rising tide of 60s feminism? Was the landscape for men portrayed by Matthew Weiner and Richard Yates and Cheever and Updike one that in the long run had a very negative impact on the men of the greatest generation? These are just some of the questions and ideas taken up by author and cultural seer Susan Jacoby, the author of The Age of American Unreason and Freethinkers and books about Alger Hiss and Robert Ingersoll, has now written a new ebook entitled The Last Men on Top, and it is my pleasure to welcome Susan Jacoby back to this program. Susan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
One of the things that you talk about and that has become so much clearer in reading this is that all of these men that controlled things, that had money and power in that period, that there was so much more fragility to it than they seemed to realize, or maybe even that we realized at the time.
Well, okay. First of all, I mean, I'm the daughter of a man who came of age during World War II, and Mad Men not only talks about them, but about the younger generation of men born during the Depression who came of age in the 50s. Those are the younger men on Mad Men. So we're talking about really two generations, but a time in which men who came of age supposedly ruled the world. Now, what Mad Men ignores is what America always ignores in general, which is class. Mm-hmm. Those men don't represent what either the average white-collar or blue-collar man lived. As I talk a good deal about my own father in the book, he was an accountant. He worked 80-hour weeks for a quarter of the year during tax season. I grew up in Michigan, had lots of friends whose fathers were in both white-collar and blue-collar jobs in the auto industry, constantly worried when auto sales were down, you know, were their fathers going to get laid off? How much power exactly did ordinary men have at a time when you're talking about middle-class men? Men in Mad Men are not middle-class. They're very upper middle class. They make more money than the vast majority of people ever made then. How much power do you really have when, at a time when social convention dictates that middle class wives did not work? Poor women always worked. Mm-hmm. But part of being middle class in the 50s and aspiring to the middle class was that your wife did not, quote, work, meaning she did not have a job. I mean, think about the pressure. What would life have been like in the terrible recession we've been living through since 2008 if so few middle-class women worked as worked at the time when I was growing up? How many more houses would have been lost to foreclosure?
I mean, we see that other side, again, using fictional characters, but we see that kind of white-collar desperation a bit in somebody like Frank Wheeler in Revolutionary Road.
Yeah, well, sure. But really, again, they had money too. I don't think really that the actual position of men, what was the bargain then really? The bargain was, and then you see in the most horrible side, April Wheeler in Revolutionary mm-hmm. Road
right.
too, the horrible other side. The middle class covenant was this. The man was responsible for supporting the family. The woman was responsible for everything domestic. The price of that for women, which is the suppression of all worldly ambition, that story has been well told by the feminist movement since the late 1960s. But the price for men, which is what happens if things go wrong, when absolutely everything depends on you, that price has been less told, partly because part of the male covenant was that you didn't talk about it.
Right.
And that part, Mad Men, that part, Mad Men has got right. But you know, I say in the book, I mean, one of the things, the tremendous amount of money that these men and Mad Men spend on adultery, I said, and it's true. Had my father had the desire to commit routine adulteries, he never would have had the time or the money. And not only that, but part of the bargain was, is women often, a lot of men like my father, just handed over their paychecks to their wives. Their wives knew where every penny went. I assure you, if my father were spending money on hotel rooms once a week for mistresses, my mother would have been asking, where was the $25? Yeah, what had that been spent on?
To what extent, then, did that those men, that 1% of at that period of time, create an aspirational culture that made it so much more difficult for other men of the generation?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, the culture of advertising of that time, talking about advertising as it affected people out there, the culture of advertising was that the woman was in the home and the man, you know, could aspire to a big car or something. But I think that's right. The aspirational culture was one in which part of your having made it was that your wife did not work. And indeed, I grew up in Michigan, and a lot of my friends' parents had not gone to college, or for the men, they were the first men in their family to go to college. They went on the GI Bill after the war. Many fewer women had gone to college. As I say in the book, one of the things you can say about this generation is that they changed one thing. For people in my father's generation, if somebody was going to go to college in a family of limited means, it was always the boy. My parents' generation were the first who sent boys as well as girls to college. Now, the idea of sending girls to college in the late 1950s was that they could marry a better class of husband. It wasn't that they were going to have careers. Nevertheless, the women of my generation were the first large generation of middle-class women to have access to higher education. And that was one thing that helped give rise to the feminist movement, too.
Given then the stress and the price that the rest of the men paid for this, time lost with families, lack of personal freedom in some respects, even lack of time to pursue personal interests, why has it always been so difficult for the culture to muster up any kind of empathy for them?
Well, there are a couple reasons. First of all, of course, the top men in that generation, they did prove to be an obstacle to women. I mean, certainly when I was a young reporter for the Washington Post, everything was run by men. There were hardly any women outside of what was then called the society section. I was helped by some men and hindered by others, but it was men who had the power. Somebody asked me stupidly why I didn't talk about women mentors. I didn't talk about women mentors because I didn't have any women mentors, because there were very few women in any positions to mentor other women then. Everything is different now. The only person at the Washington Post who was really an influential woman was Katharine Graham when I started to work there, and she owned the newspaper. But there were not a lot. There were not national women reporters. There were not women in jobs of power and influence and reporting jobs of the kind that I aspire to. So we tend to see things through the prism of the present. I think one of the reasons for this sort of half demonization and half sentimentalization of the quote greatest generation, as Tom Brokaw called it, I think it is that people tend to see the past through the prism of today's arguments. The cultural arguments about the roles of men and women today are all about balancing responsibilities, about balancing home versus work, and they're a discussion and an argument that involves both women and men. But so when you look back at the men of my father's generation, it is easy for both hard-pressed women and men in two-income homes and two-job homes to see the past as maybe both better and worse than it was. Better because the man had a little woman at home, dinner waiting for him, and the martini at the door, so to speak. You don't hear anything about the 80-hour work weeks and the 3 months a year my father left for work at 4:30 a.m. And worse, because there is this kind of romanticization, cocktails and clothes. Everybody's telling me how much they love the clothes women there. Well, what they don't know is what those girdles felt like in the early 1960s and the 1950s. The clothes are better today for both women and men. So in other words, everybody tends to look at the past in some ways in a more benign way, because what we're all involved in today are the problems we have today. You know, all I can say is everybody who is bitching about two-earner households and what a terrible time it is combining raising children and having two people working, they ought to see how hard it was living on one income and how much worry and stress there was for both men and women when every single thing depended on one man's job. And I think of my father, how much he wanted to spend more time at home. You know, that old cliche about nobody ever said I wish I'd worked more.
Right.
That in the months before his death from lung cancer in 1986, and my father said the greatest regret of his life was that he hadn't spent more time with my brother and me while we were growing up. Well, how could he with the hours he worked? And how would we have survived financially if he didn't work those hours?
The other part of this story is the way all of this transpired kind of in reverse, that the white male power structure of the time was completely unaware of the way it was being challenged, of the challenges that were just over the horizon, and the way in which once those challenges were engaged in and the impact that it had filtered down, that the rest of the men had no idea what was coming either, and it had a worse impact for a lot of them.
Right. Well, sure. Well, you know, part of the fun of watching Mad Men, of course, is these guys have no idea of what's coming. You know,
right.
It's like those old cartoons in which people are walking along happily eating hamburgers and there's a hungry lion just around the corner that
right.
they don't see. But of course we know that, and that's in retrospect. I don't think in terms of jobs and men's jobs, I think that the impact of the feminist movement really has been greatly exaggerated, both the feminist movement as it was in the 1970s. One of the things everybody forgets is we had an expanding economy then. Economy needed more workers. Men didn't get deprived of jobs because women entered the workforce. There were just more jobs. Now, that's not true today, but mostly today when we're talking about men versus women in the labor force, it is my opinion, and it's backed up by good statistics, that all of this talk about the end of men is absolute nonsense. It's one of those cultural ideas that sort of gets a hold and people who are making money from it can't let go. In fact, who has been affected are poor men. It's not that women have, quote, taken the good jobs from men. White upper middle class men in education have not been affected at all. And blue collar men in manufacturing jobs have been affected, obviously, not by women taking their jobs, but by the fact that those jobs have disappeared. They've gone overseas or gone away altogether. And that has nothing to do with women in the workforce or with feminism.
Arguing that the men on top did well in those days and are still doing well today, that the consequences, as we're saying, are always pushed down the class ladder.
Exactly. Exactly. The consequences are pushed down the class ladder, and not even so much, well, today. One of the things that we know is there is so much more economic inequality between the top and the bottom than there was in the 1960s and 50s. And also, I think even more germane to my book, is that there is much greater inequality between, say, the top 1 or 2% and the middle class. And that's really important. The middle class incomes have been stagnant while the top 5% or so have gone up, and that's where the most of the wealth gain is. And that of course affects both men and women, and it means that the two-earner family, as far as the middle fifth, today the middle fifth of American income earners is where women contribute the largest proportion of family income, about 45%. Back in the 1950s, middle-class women contributed very little family income because so few of them worked, although poor women always contributed a large portion of the family income. All of those things have been accentuated by growing income inequality today, and again, have nothing to do with the relative roles of men and women, although they have an effect on everyone in terms of, I think, in fact, single mothers today probably are in the best position to understand how the men of my father's generation, who were solely responsible economically for their families, the kinds of conflicts that they felt. In other words, not married women or married men today, but single mothers who are the sole support of their families, probably have more in common with the men of my father's generation than anybody else in our society today. Everything depends on them, just like everything depended on the fathers of my father's generation.
Given that the income gap is so much wider, and given that it is more of a zero-sum game because there are less jobs available, as you were talking about before, what impact is that having, and what impact might it have going forward on gender relationships?
I don't know. I don't see the income gap growing significantly smaller, certainly not in the next decade or two. Two income families are going to continue to be the norm, except, and this may interest you, it's not generally known because books about women's roles are written by a very small percentage of very rich women too, like Sheryl Sandberg. But in general, the higher the income is, who is the only group in America where women contribute a negligible portion of the family income? The top 20%. And those women, many more of them, don't work than middle-class women because they don't have to. That's a fact, and it's, by the way, it's an uncomfortable fact for feminists. There are a lot of women who just plain don't want to work, but just as I'm sure there are a lot of men who would like not to work. But the fact is women in the top fifth of income earners in this country are about the only people who have the choice of working or not, because their husbands make so much money, if they don't want to work, they don't have to work. The idea that every rich woman wants to work is nonsense. A lot of them don't.
Mm-hmm.
Or they wouldn't have such a smaller income of working, a smaller proportion of working married women than in the middle fifth of American income earners.
All this talk, all this debate about the end of men, what do you, besides all the conversation that it engenders, what do you think is the net result of it? Anything?
In this case, first of all, it's a perception for a very small class of people, and it is not reality. I think, you know, if you look at the graduating class of Harvard or Yale, you will see that those men are doing every bit as well as the women. And I don't think that the social structure of people who come from, one of the things we know is that the determining factor in how well young people do is how much money their parents make, which also correlates into how much education. And in other words, it's very dubious that an ordinary 4-year or even more 2-year community college degree helps anyone. What we know helps people succeed in life is if they have well-off parents who can give them advantages. That's not going to change. And certainly as far as the middle class in America goes, the fact that both husbands and wives work are not going to change. Now, do you know what I really think? And I'm too old. I'm in my 60s, but I talk to people in their 20s. I think one of the things about the end of men, and I am just quoting women in their 20s whom I know.
Mm-hmm.
It enables men in their 20s who aren't doing well to feel sorry for themselves and blame women for it. But that I am only quoting women I have talked to in their 20s about it. I am too old to personally know about this.
Right.
But and also, of course, one of the things that the economic situation in general is doing is it's very related to delaying in marriage and childbearing for both sexes. The job situation for all young people of both sexes is definitely, and I'm not sure, by the way, that the delaying in marriage and child rearing is a bad thing at all. I don't look back with nostalgia to when things were different and, you know, my mother had her first child at 23 and her second child at 26, and my mother was probably later than her generation, but I don't think that delayed marriage and childbearing is necessarily a bad thing. I just think that we should look back at the last generation, not with nostalgia, because there was plenty that was horrible for women and for men in that, but also not with the kind of demonization. You know, I look at those men in Mad Men, and, you know, basically Mad Men is a portrait of men who are allowed to behave like pigs as long as they bring home a paycheck. And this is in a way they behave like pigs, but in a way it's also sort of glamorized. I said the cocktails, the socializing, all of that kind of thing. That really wasn't so great, and it wasn't something that was available to men. Oh, and also the other thing relating to your question about how does the idea that men are being displaced by women affect things? Well, one of the things that it does, we see how the idea, everybody is interested in Don Draper because even though he acts like a pig, he shows a sensitive side. He worries about acting like a pig, unlike some of the other characters who act like pigs and don't worry about it. But I think when you look at the idea of the end of men, it also kind of gives men permission to behave badly too. So, but where does that get you? Men had permission to behave badly in the Mad Men era, and some men have permission to behave badly today because, oh, poor babies, the women are supposedly taking their jobs, which they aren't. But really, the truth is that in the Mad Men era, most men didn't have those kinds of permissions either. And although they did, you know, I think about it, and I began my book with this. The sound, my father told me, again, not long before he died, what he wanted to be was a high school history teacher, and he would have been great at it. If he had lived in a time when it was all right for women to work, and my mother was tremendously competent and ultimately did go back to work after my brother and I were in college, and she would have been a lot happier if she'd gone to work a lot sooner. If my father had lived in that era, maybe instead of being an accountant, which he really didn't like, maybe he could have gone on the GI Bill and finished college and become a high school history teacher. If they'd had two incomes, he wouldn't have had to make so much money or work so many hours to have a middle class standard of living. So I think, you know, looking back on that era with people with ordinary jobs, with nostalgia, you're not thinking about all of the things that they couldn't do. That it might have been better for both of my mother and my father if two-income families had been the norm instead of something that labeled a man a failure and a woman as having chosen her husband wrongly.
I guess the other question is whether or not there was more potential for social mobility, though, at that point, and that today there's greater reinforcement, particularly in the areas of education you were talking about before, a reinforcement of class stratification.
Well, now you're going to a subject beyond my book, but yes, there was more social mobility then. And the reason there was social mobility, again, something that's just forgotten particularly by conservative discourse, which talks about people making it on their own. No generation other than the World War II generation has ever benefited more from government benefits, which were largely responsible for the social mobility of the 1950s and early 60s, than the World War II generation. The GI Bill was the greatest social mobility force that has ever existed in this society. The GI Bill enabled an entire generation of people who, if it hadn't existed, would have gone back to work in factories, to go to college, and move up, both in terms of class and in terms of income. There's never been any, the GI Bill today doesn't begin to provide the benefits that the GI Bill then did, in which you could go to college. You could put yourself through college without paying for anything on the GI Bill. When my parents bought a house, they got it with a Veterans Administration loan at 4% interest. Nobody can buy a house today, who has nothing at that kind of interest. So you're talking about huge government benefits, which a grateful nation showered on the men and their families who had been involved in what America still considers the last good war. And it's one reason, by the way, I think Tom Brokaw is quite wrong to call him the greatest generation. I don't see how you get to be greatest just by virtue of having been the right age to fight in a war. They were in many ways the luckiest generation. The benefits they got were tremendous. Nothing like it has been seen in America since then, and even less today than before. So the social mobility was in large movement generated not by people just relying on themselves, but by people relying on themselves with great big push from government spending, which we had the money to do then in a growing economy.
Susan Jacoby, her new e-book is The Last Men on Top. Susan, it's been wonderful. I thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
I really enjoy it.
Thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.